The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's The Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, back in New York, streaming video live from our studios. You can go to GaryKnoll.com or ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com if you would like to watch today's show. I just got in about 1 o'clock this morning after a 9-hour flight, and happy to be back in New York City. We have a lot of work to do, filming a lot every day, and getting ready for our big September 21st double premiere. 5 p.m. will be Knocking on the Devil's Door. 7 o'clock will be the big conference. And we have people coming in from Fukushima, Japan, from around the world. Vandana Shiva, Greg Palast, Carl Grossman, Harvey Wasserman, have all these wonderful anti-nuclear voices. And then at 8:30, we have a second showing of a brand new film, a feature film. In fact, it's the number one winning film in the world in documentaries this year thus far. It's called Death by Medicine. Double feature, press conference, happening. Get involved. It's our first step to closing down all the nuclear plants in the world. And we're starting with the one at Indian Point. Anyhow, today, back in the studio is my guest. In this third segment of our program will be Dr. Lawrence Pilevsky. We're going to talk about the latest on vaccines and the dangers of vaccines. Then, new information I can promise you have not heard from a very qualified source. It comes from a professor of law, from a dean of the University of California at Berkeley Law School. Obama feared what? When he took office, what did he fear that was the reason, the real reason, his administration allowed crimes against humanity, overt acts of illegality to be conducted by the previous administration and chose not to prosecute it? We'll give you the answer to that. For those of you who would like a different impression of what's going down on 9/11, we'll share that with you. We'll go to all these issues, social issues, environmental issues, health issues, starting now. First and foremost, most Americans are not aware that as we speak, the FDA is aggressively trying to stop your right to take any supplement. This happened back in the mid-1980s. We fought them. I personally went to 52 cities in the United States. I debated the commissioner of the FDA. I debated legislators. In the end, we won our freedom of choice. It was called the Deshaies Amendment, which allowed you to take your supplements. Now the FDA wants to get rid of that. This is a part of their effort that failed with Codex, but now this administration, President Obama, is fully supporting the pharmaceutical industry, the genetic engineering industry, and members of Congress are siding with him. So today is the day, nationwide, where we're asking you to call your legislator and say, no, we want our freedoms of choice. So this is today. And let me tell you something. If you don't do it, there's a high probability we will lose. Now, I'm suing the FDA, as I did 3 years ago. And they were never able to knock that lawsuit out, but they can drag it through the courts indefinitely. We have 13 lawyers working on that, on mandatory vaccines. More to come on that. But now we have hired the best attorney in the United States. In fact, I'm filming him in Washington, D.C., along with Ralph Nader and other people this Monday, on this whole issue. And we will at least get a temporary stay, but that does not mean we win. What causes us to win is for you to let your legislator know. If they vote to allow us to have our vitamins taken away and the FDA's rules to be in place, you will absolutely, positively not be able to take a single vitamin, period. Herb, mineral. How many of you would die? How many people do you know would die? How many would get sick? How many are only alive and well because of what you've been able to do? This is really serious, and I ask you to take this very seriously. This is from Deborah Ray and Craig Smith, and here's what they say. Just a reminder that our call-in lobbying day is only 2 days away. And by the way, that was it's actually today. They said this 2 days ago, but I just got in and just got this early this morning. We're hoping that each of you will set time aside today to phone your senators and representatives and voice your opposition to NDI. NDI, Dietary Supplement Guidance. This guidance is clearly intended to lead us to a full approval system for supplements modeled on drugs. If that happens, supplemental costs will soar and availability will be limited. A new federal vaccine plan and bad state bill. The crony capitalism in vaccines just got worse, and don't expect any help from so-called small government candidate Rick Perry. A state beat action alert. You know, that's separate, but call and tell them you're against the FDA having anything to do with regulating vitamins as drugs. And here's the overview. Here's what they want to do. They want you to believe that if you eat walnuts because they have good fats, that that's a drug. And therefore, you can't buy any food. You couldn't buy an orange because you wanted vitamin C. You couldn't eat a carrot because you wanted vitamin A. You couldn't eat, let's say, some grain, whole grain, because that's B-complex or fiber. So the FDA has become such a fascist police Gestapo, and they are vile. They are criminal. They are absolutely shamelessly bought and sold by the corporate elites that the left has absolutely coddled up to, which shame on the Democrats for being for every vaccine and every drug and drugging every kid and diagnosing. Shame on you. You have no shame. You only have your intellectual hubris and arrogance. Well, you don't take vitamins because you're not interested in your health. But for those who do, I ask you to call and don't wait for anyone in your political parties to represent you. They won't. They've already been bought and sold. We're getting now to the point where every day, anything you take for granted, you better not. One man was just given a $5,000 fine because he was found to have planted too many organic vegetables in his backyard. That's the level to which bureaucrats will go today to stop you from engaging in your freedom of choice of your lifestyle. Now they want to take away our right to use our vitamins. So in other words, if you just want to eat hot dogs, hamburgers, french fries, and cola and coffee, that's fine. You have a right to that. But if you want to be healthy, you cannot associate any health with any food. For example, if you said, I'm going to drink this water because it's clean spring water and I want clean, healthy water, that's making a health claim. The FDA says, no, then it's a drug. Then your water's a drug. Has to be tested. Has to be approved. If you want to take a glass of orange juice for vitamin C, can't do that because then you're making a claim that the orange juice is got vitamin C, which could help you with your health, and there's no proof of that. In other words, the FDA would like to take us back to where we're nothing but a nation of sheep, whether we have had no advances in health science, where there is no such thing as dietetic sciences or health sciences. They would like to abolish, like Obama, no justice in any of the 500,000 peer-reviewed studies on vitamins and minerals alone, as if they don't exist. If you want to eat cherries because they can turn off pain, can't do that. That's a health claim. I don't exaggerate. These are real situations. Back off on this. Be like the Europeans, you know, those people who decided not to get involved. It was too much of an effort. It's not going to happen here. Can't happen here. There's too many of us. We're the largest economy in the world. Yes, they are. We have more people involved in sporting economy. 500 million people. Yeah, you do. And then you didn't get involved. And April 1st, Codex got involved, became the law of the land. And now you can't buy any herbs, can you? Or vitamins, or minerals, or coenzyme Q10, or NADH. You can't buy any of that, can you? So what happened when you became indifferent and lazy, but you had a lot of time to hang out at those French cafes and talk about the world, didn't you? Well, then there's real life, and it passed you by. Can it happen in America? Could, if we let the Democrats and Republicans have anything to say about it. But thank God there are a lot of us who are independent-minded and realize that our government has become a fascistic voice for an oligarchical elite and corporate elitist. The pharmaceutical people who are behind this, they're the ones who make the money. After all, if we're spending $20 billion a year on supplements, and that means we're not getting sick, and that means we're not taking their medications, and that means when flu season comes, we take our coenzyme Q10 or we take our wild oregano oil or our vitamin C instead of their over-the-counter drugs, that's competition. And in America, the one thing we don't like is fair competition. We like monopolistic competition. You know, where you have maybe instead of 100 companies, you have two. And they're equally big and powerful. We like to have an Apple and a Microsoft, but we don't want all the others. So this is the FDA's final assault. Will they win it? That's up to you. And that's where we're at. So you call those legislators in Washington, who I have no respect for at all. I believe every single member of Congress should be fired, without exception. Every single one. Because they live as if this is an entitlement. And I just went through their financial reports, all of them on an airplane. 56 of them are multi-millionaires. Where's their school teacher? Where's their social worker? Where's their firefighter, police officer? Where's their just an ordinary person, a plumber? They don't exist. They're all powerful people. So you call your senator, you call your House member today, and you tell them, no, you do not want the FDA having anything to do under NDI with our dietary supplements, because our supplements are not drugs. We have a right to eat foods because we believe they're healthy for us. They don't want us to be able to do that. I remember debating the former commissioner of the FDA. And on the table, I put some carrots. And I said, sir, under your advice, a homemaker could not go to the supermarket and buy these carrots until they first went to the physician and got a prescription for the carrots, because the carrots contain vitamin A, and the reason for eating the carrots would be to improve the vitamin A content of the body and therefore help you with night vision. Now, the science shows that, and here's a stack of scientific studies, over 300, showing that vitamin A helps improve night vision and protects our eyes. You're saying that a person shouldn't have the right to associate any health claim with any food or supplement. And then I put eggs on the table, and I said, and here are some eggs. And if a person bought these eggs, but they said, I'm buying the eggs because that's where I want to get my protein, because protein builds strong muscles, can't do that. You just made a health claim. Or here's my glass of orange juice. I take this because of vitamin C. You can't do that either. So you want us to believe that we should eat food without any thought of what the food's doing for us. Surely you can't be serious. Oh, but he was serious. He lost the debate, and that was a defining moment of people watching, because until that point, they had controlled the argument. It is for the safety of your children that we want this legislation, because they could die or be poisoned. Trouble is, I had all the records in the National Poison Control Center showing nobody was killed from taking vitamins. Nobody was, but they sure were killed by taking nonsteroidal anti-inflammatories like aspirin and all these other drugs. So every place they went in an argument, when I was able to debate them, they lost. The trouble is now they're not debating me. They're not debating any of us. They won't debate Mike Adams, myself, or any of the other people out there asking for them to come onto a public forum and debate, because they'll lose. So they work their power as they normally do in Washington, fed a little cesspool that Washington is, behind closed doors, with the pharmaceutical industry always present. Just remember, it is the owners of the pharmaceutical industry who are the power. It is the foundations, the front groups, the scientists for hire, the talking head experts, who then present the argument on the left and the right. And that's why you never hear a third opinion and the two are more congenial than anything else. Next up. So, by the way, we are making a major effort. By the way, you could call the FDA, but you would have to assume someone at the FDA actually knows how to speak with you, and I doubt that's the situation. So just know who your legislators are, and call them in and tell them you don't want the FDA involved in your life when it comes to your supplements and your foods and the right. Here's something. This is from David McRaney from Alternet. Coffee, an illusion. Here's what he says. The misconception. Coffee stimulates you. But hold on a second. Isn't that why most people take it? Because it's a natural stimulant? It's good for you? No. The truth, you become addicted to caffeine quickly, and soon you're drinking coffee to cure withdrawal from more of the stimulation. A warm cup of coffee with delicious cream topped with a frothy head. You smell it brewing and feel cozy inside as you browse cakes and brownies, scones and biscotti. You get some of it in you and you feel alive again and you feel superhuman. Suddenly you feel like John Nash. You can't keep up with your own mind as geometric symbols float over the magazine articles in your lap. Someone strikes up a conversation about healthcare and suddenly everything you've heard about the topic is to the tip of your tongue. Damn, coffee's awesome. Except, of course, that's an illusion. The truth is, once you've been drinking coffee for a while, the feeling you are getting after a cup isn't the difference between the normal you and the super you, it's the difference between the addict before and after effects. Okay? Caffeine is an adenosine antagonist. This means it prevents adenosine from doing its job. You've heard me mention many times in this program adenosine triphosphate, ATP. That's what actually causes energy, real natural energy. Now, there are some things that can facilitate it, like coenzyme Q10, NADH, L-carnitine. Those are good ways of facilitating it. Well, your brain is filled with keys which fit specific keyholes. Adenosine is one of those keys, but caffeine can fit in the same keyhole. When caffeine gets in there, it keeps adenosine from getting in. Adenosine does a lot of stuff all throughout your body, but the most noticeable job it has is to suppress your nervous system. With caffeine stuck in the keyhole, adenosine can't calm you down. It can't make you drowsy. It can't get you to shut up. That crazy wired feeling you get when you drink a lot of coffee is what it feels like when your brain can't turn itself off. To compensate, your brain creates a ton of new receptor sites. The plan is to have more keyholes than false keys. The result is you become very sensitive to adenosine, and without coffee, you get overwhelmed by its effect. After 8 hours of sleep, you wake up with a head swimming with adenosine. You feel like crap until you get that black gold in you and clean out those receptor sites. That perks you up, but it's adding a lot of bad to you. You end up at zero. In addition, caffeine stimulates your adrenal glands, which makes you feel like you could take a bullet and eat glass. When the adrenaline runs dry, you feel like you've been running a marathon, which leads you to look for more coffee to get those glands pumping again. After a few rides on the adrenal roller coaster, you crash. You might think all this is probably, well, it takes a while, but it takes about 7 days to become addicted to caffeine. You heard me right, 7 days. Once addicted, you need more and more coffee to get buzzed as your brain gets covered in receptor sites. Neurologists report seeing patients regularly who drink 2 or 3 pots of coffee in one sitting before they're able to start their day. Coffee also releases dopamine, the feel-good chemical in the brain, which is released when you have an orgasm, win the lottery, or shoot heroin. A similar addiction cycle with dopamine leads to depression and fatigue when you're drinking coffee. Finally, coffee takes about 6 hours to leave your system. So if you drink coffee 6 hours or less before going to bed, you won't reach deep sleep as often. This means you wake up less rested and need more coffee. If you've been drinking coffee for a while, you're already nearly as much out of it as you did in the beginning, and you're no closer to curing your addiction. So that's the latest on the truth about coffee. It's a complete addictive. One last thing on the good side. I'm always trying to bring you in my travels the foods, the herbs, the beverages that are really super. And you can add them as one more thing we can be happy about, that we can bring into our system. The latest is what is called rooibos. It is R-O-O-I-B-O-S. And it's even stronger than green tea, red tea, and black tea. You find it in South America. It's made from Asphalaetheus linearis. That's an indigenous shrub that grows only in the mountains, of South Africa, not South America. It has 50% more antioxidants than green tea. It helps the aging process slow down. It traps free radicals. It helps the production of normal cell function. It is tremendous on strengthening a weakened immune system. And found recently, the Japanese, when they used rooibos, it mimics superoxide dismutase, which is very good at attacking free radicals. It's all natural. There's no additives, colors, or preservatives. It will help you relieve insomnia, irritability, headaches, stomach ulcers, nausea, constipation, heartburn. It has anti-mutagenic effect, anti-carcinogenic effect, anti-inflammatory effect, and antiviral effect. It has alpha-hydroxy acid, which helps your skin. It's just good for a lot of stuff. It gives you strong bones, strong teeth. It's great in manganese. It helps you with mild depression. It's a natural sedative. It controls appetite, and hence that's beneficial for weight loss. It helps pacify infants with colic and stomach cramps and sleeping problems. It contains oxalic acid and can therefore be enjoyed by persons suffering from kidney stones. And it increases absorption of iron in the body. So just add this to one of the superfoods you probably haven't heard of. But in my travels, I'm always looking for something new and important. It is pronounced rooibos, R-O-Y-B-O-S-S, but it's spelled R-O-O-I-B-O-S. I'm Gary Noll, back in a moment. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Noll. We're going to go to our guest here in just a second, but two short pieces of information. I could not understand why, with all the proven crimes of the previous administration, there'd be no effort to even bring in an independent prosecutor, one who would simply look at the evidence to determine, were there crimes? If so, who perpetrated them? Where did they come from? To what degree were they implemented? And then hold those people accountable. Here could be one of the reasons. Now, this has been confirmed, and the person who did the interviewing was Andrew Krieg, an executive director of Justice Integrity Project. he reviews abuse of federal investigative procedures. He's an attorney, and he has a strong background from Yale Law School, University of Chicago School of Law, and here's what he found. He did an interview just this past week at an informal forum talking about 9/11. And to his surprise, Dean of the University of California, Berkeley Law School, Christopher Edley, Jr., he was the sixth highest-ranking member of the 2008 post-election transition team preparing Obama's administration, revealed the team's thinking on September 2nd in moderating a forum. He said that that they feared if President Obama looked into the crimes of the Bush administration, that he'd be ousted in a coup, and that then Republicans or would block his policy agenda, and therefore they decided to back off. My thoughts are on this, that if they feared that the military national security forces that the president is supposed to command, and the Republicans have intimidated him right from the start of his presidency, even after voters in 2008 rejected Republicans by the largest combined presidential congressional mandate in U.S. history. What does that say about we're living with the fear of a coup? Who? Oh, could it be any of the 800,000 people all assembled within Homeland Security? Could be this secret, super secret 17 national security agencies with $54 billion in known budget? Who are these people? And why would we tolerate this? Why hasn't the left or the right had investigations into this to see if these feelings were accurate or not? I think it tells us a lot if we fear a coup from people in the permanent government. That could tell us a lot about why there has been an aggressive war on terror, increasing the military-industrial complex's power, the spy agency's power around the world in the United States, and not honoring the habeas corpus, not honoring the right to bring these criminals to justice. Anyhow, that's just something. And finally, this is from J.D. Hayes, and I'll quote this. You think we owe $14.5 trillion? The real figure is $211 trillion. Remember the tussle between Congress and the White House earlier this summer over raising the nation's debt limit? Supporters of the deal, including President Obama, tried to assuage our angst over the incredible amount of money, $14.5 trillion, our nation owes, by saying, in essence, don't worry, we can handle a debt that size, based upon our gross domestic product. Only the real amount of money our government owes is $211 trillion, according to a top economics professor. And Lawrence Kolakoff, who served as a senior economist on President Reagan's Council of Economic Advisors, said in a recent interview that the debt ceiling agreement, which was supposed to include debt budget cuts, but must contain no real spending reductions at all, was an exercise in futility. Quote, we have all these unofficial debts that are massive compared to the official debt. And if you add up all the, quote, the promises that have been made for spending obligations, including defense expenditures, and you subtract all the taxes that you expect to collect, the difference is $211 trillion. That's the fiscal gap. That's a true indebtedness. Is this figure a big secret in Washington, D.C.? Do our leaders simply not understand the gravity of the situation? Or more likely, are they content with sweeping it under the rug now so the next generation has to deal with it? How about that? I'm Gary Noll. Let's go over and say hello to my guest standing by. He is Dr. Lawrence Palevsky. That's P-A-L-E-V-S-K-Y. He is a board-certified pediatrician who uses holistic approaches of pediatric medicine for children's illnesses. And over the years, he has become an outspoken critic of vaccination and an expert in vaccine history and science. He is the head of a private practice clinic, Holistic Child Health, in Northport, New York, where he has become renowned for his treatment of children with autism, autism spectrum disorders, and children's learning disabilities, neurological conditions. And nice to have you with us today, Lawrence.
Hi, Gary. How are you?
Good. Lawrence, we're about 3 weeks away from finishing what hopefully would be the most definitive review of the scientific literature ever. I have several scholars that I have hired who have been working quietly for a long time, and I've asked them simply three questions, and I'm going to ask you the same three. And by the way, they've reviewed thousands upon thousands of studies. Here's what I asked them. Everything in the world of vaccine is predicated upon three assumptions. Vaccines are safe, and the science proves it. Vaccines are effective individually and collectively. The science fully proves that. And vaccines confer complete immunity. The science confers that. As a result of the science being unquestionable, then all of the mandates that we should have all these vaccines, whether it's flu vaccines for healthcare workers or children, or the elderly or pregnant, or Gardasil, all of this then follows upon these foundational assumptions. And then when I spoke with Barbara Fisher and so many other people who've done so much good work in educating about the harm that has come from vaccines, I have one overriding problem in the entire vaccine injury field, virtually without exception. And I saw this after the film Vaccine Nation and the subsequent film Autism Made in USA came out. They all agreed my child was normal until the vaccination, but they all agreed they're pro-vaccines. And they just believe their child was unfortunate to get the bad vaccine or was genetically susceptible to the good vaccine, but it was the child that had the environmental susceptibility in their body, meaning their genes made them vulnerable. Now, the entire field believes that. Dr. Andrew Wakefield believes in that. And so I said, okay, then maybe I've got it wrong. So I went back, and for the last 2.5 years, we've done this very massive, quiet, comprehensive review of every single article that orthodox medicine and science has used to form their argument. Now, my report will be coming out. It's about 700 pages, all scientific. And we are finding they do not have science on their side to prove that vaccines are safe. They do not have it that they are effective, and they certainly don't have it that a vaccine is the same as conferring full immunological properties and antibodies that will protect that person from whatever they've been vaccinated for. Now, that's what we've come up with. I would like your thoughts on this, since you have done a little more than most, since you've actually read the literature. What are your feelings on this, since no one in the anti-vaccine field, they're anti the diseases or illnesses that come from the vaccines, but they're still saying, get your vaccines. And a lot of these autism industry groups are getting money from pharmaceutical companies that also make vaccines, which I think is just bizarre. Your thoughts, please.
Well, I think, Gary, first of all, the ideological stand in the culture has to believe that vaccines are safe, effective, and confer immunity. And so in many respects, there are most people who don't want to even believe that the science could say that vaccines are not safe, that they're not effective, and they don't confer immunity, because the ideology is going to crumble. And so it almost appears irrelevant as to whether or not the science says that vaccines are not safe or they're not effective, because the ideology has to hold true. You can't have the Institute of Medicine admitting that vaccines may not be safe, or the American Academy of Pediatrics, or the FDA. They cannot take that stance. And so they have to make sure that science continues to be put forth that show that vaccines are safe, effective, and confer immunity. And the problem is not whether the science is true or not. The problem is whether or not you can break people's adherence to the ideology. There are a couple of major assumptions that people make about the underpinnings of vaccine science, and that is that germs cause disease, And so anytime a child gets sick, it must be a germ that's causing it. That's not fully true. The other problem with vaccine science is that people are made to believe that if you don't see a measles infection in a community, then the measles virus isn't there. That's not true either. In all likelihood, the information that codes for the measles virus is present in the community even before the illness occurs. So the philosophy of vaccinators is we're going to give you an introduction of the material through an injection before you encounter that germ, so that in the event you do encounter that germ, you're going to be protected. What is becoming more and more apparent is that the body is infested with trillions of bacteria, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of viruses, all at the same time. And that the belief that somehow the virus or bacteria that we vaccinate against is not already in the body is a problem. And so we're basing a lot of the vaccine science on false basic assumptions. There's no possible way that vaccines can be safe, because the very nature of injecting material into the body impairs the immune system. The use of adjuvants is designed to catalyze the immune reaction in such a way that the body produces an antibody against the bacteria or the virus. But it also catalyzes an immune response against everything that's in the vaccine. No one has ever studied whether or not anything else in the vaccine is reacted to the point where it brings on adverse outcomes. All we care about is antibodies to virus or antibodies to bacteria, which do not confer lifelong immunity. And at the same time, this injection destroys the immune system. We haven't investigated any of the ramifications of the injection of any kind of material into the body. We just assume if we're going to put it into the body, it's safe because science has said it's safe. What if the viruses or bacteria that we vaccinate against are already in the cells of our body? What if they're already in the DNA in the nucleus of our cells? What if the linings of the body already contain the bacteria that are living in our bodies that we then inject? We're not even assuming that it's possible that these organisms can already be in our body. We're only assuming that if the illness isn't here, that the organisms couldn't be here. And so if these viral and bacterial particles are already part of our bodies and we're injecting them, any injection of foreign protein makes the body see it as foreign. And the result is the body's rejection of what is injected. And so if the body has seen bacteria and viruses as safe, the immune systems have tolerated them, accepted them, lived with them, and then you inject them into the body now sees them as foreign and starts to reject them. And so this is the massive setup for autoimmune disease, and we're just ignoring these basic assumptions, and we're just assuming, oh, vaccines must be safe because the authorities say so, and they must work because the authorities say so, and they must confer immunity because the authorities say so. The authorities have to say so. They have no other choice at this point. They're too deep into the program. But the basic underpinnings, the basic assumptions, are all wrong.
Irrational beliefs create bubbles. Irrational belief that the income that I will get from my house will continue to go up and I'll just continue to take money against that means that I'm using my house as an ATM machine, and that's what millions of Americans did until the bubble collapsed. All bubbles will collapse.
Mm-hmm.
But the bubble in medicine, the bubble is that whatever you're doing as a group, as long as you're doing it based upon irrational beliefs, no one can question it, because we don't question official dogma. We only question non-official challenges. So you either approach science, medicine, and healing as you would economics or anything else from either a rationalist point of view or a behavioralist point of view. So you have two beliefs. You're dealing with behavioralists who say, look, if I believe in something, it must be right or I wouldn't believe in it. And if we're giving these vaccines, they must be safe and effective, or we wouldn't be giving them, would we?
Correct.
The rationalist says, but prove your point. Show me where your underlying belief is correct. The behavioralists then become limbic, and they say, the fear of losing control of the power that is given to me by society, I can only respond with irrational behavior.
Correct.
Hence, irrational behavior is the guiding force for almost everything we do in life.
Right.
The denial of global warming, irrational behavior. If you put good quality emission controls into factories, you will cause jobs. Irrational behavior. You actually increase jobs. You may decrease some profits for the money you're putting in to improve emission controls, but it takes people to put those in place, and that actually improves jobs. But as long as you can get people believing in something is irrational, that we should make Kim Kardashian, whatever her name is, Kim Big Ass, because that's all she is. She became famous for having a big ass. Nothing else. No other quality. And I'll bet she has more brains in her ass than she does in her head. But she's now multi-gazillionaire for no other reason because of exuberant behavioral emotions towards her of now wanting to immolate her. So it's not about, we never heard a word in their marriage about do they really love each other. Are they sharing any passion together? It's how much her ring cost, how much her wedding gown didn't cost her from Vera Wang, how much that she went a bigger wedding than the royals of England. And that is this kind of irrational beliefs creating a bubble that we all jump into this bubble. And the Democrats have this irrational belief. The Republicans have this irrational belief. So they all get into the bubble. The bubble of drown the government in the bathtub. The other is massive spending of the government to save the world. These are both bubbles. These are both irrational bubbles. And the moment you challenge them, you're excluded as a person that is too extreme. So hence, in our society today, and this is my final thought on this, to be rational, to be legitimate in your rational arguments, you are immediately excluded to the left or the right, and hence you're no longer taken seriously.
Well, I mean, Gary, if this were truly a scientific discussion, then there would be a tremendous ease by which the dialogue could happen in public. People who had opposing views could actually be welcomed into an open discussion where audiences, community-wide, regionally-wide, nationwide, would be able to listen in and hear the debate. But this is not about the science, and this is what a growing number of citizens in this country are recognizing, is that if we're really going to talk science, there's going to be groups of questions that are going to be raised for which we don't have answers, and there are going to be groups of questions raised for which we do have answers that the authorities don't want the general public to understand the answers to. So all we can do, and all that I keep doing, is educating people one by one, giving them the opportunity to expand the level of thinking that they have, to accept that maybe there's more to know than what we thought we knew, and to take them off the platform of dogma and the platform of fear into empowerment with information. What people decide to do with the information is their choice, but the idea is to start bringing people in who are willing to hear the information. Authorities are not willing to hear the information.
Lawrence, let me just add one thing on that, and I appreciate what you just said. What you said highlights an underlying belief that I have, that we believe that we are conscious of the value of all of our choices, but in point of fact, our belief in our free will to make a choice is never challenged against the irrational motivation and the irrational stimulation, the irrational commodification of how we end up with a belief. And hence we end up with beliefs that we have to give away all of our freedom because a terrorist is going to attack us. But in point of fact, we've had 500,000 people killing each other in the United States, but only 43 deaths from terrorism in the last 20 years. So when you look at it rationally, you come away from a different way than how you should protect yourself than if you have an irrational belief. The irrational beliefs allows the police state to come in, totalitarian efforts to come in, the same way in medicine. If you tell someone, if you do not take this vaccine, you cannot come to this school, you cannot work in this hospital, you are being a bad parent.
Or your child is going to die.
Yes, that's an irrational belief.
Right.
All right, but bring rationality to that, and immediately that is the third rail. Here is my final thought on this. In all discussions in the body politic, the reason we do not have open, honest, conscious, and sensible conversations about religion, about sexual preference, about politics, about finance, about health, about the environment, is because the third rail. The third rail in all these discussions is rationality. And we do not go where rational beliefs would challenge the power and the control that the irrational exuberance holds over the choices we make, which denies the positive outcome of any free choice.
Correct. And, you know, I mean, as long as, you know, as a medical doctor trained at a New York University School of Medicine, as long as I go out and speak the truths that I was taught to believe, I'm a good doctor, I'm a good soldier, and I'm adhering to the dogma and the ideology. What people forget when they hear some of the views that I have or some of the questions that I raise, what they forget is that I was trained to think exactly the way the ideology is thinking. What they don't realize is that I was also trained to question. My medical education told me, ask questions, look at the science, evaluate the science. What's there? What's not there? Does the science that we're told really say what it is that we're told? And so in doing that, I have come up with an understanding greater than what the dogma says is true. And so now all of a sudden, I'm no longer a good soldier. I'm no longer thinking rationally. I'm no longer part of the crew. I'm no longer part of the boys' club because I'm now raising questions about what it is that we're taught. If that were truly an open society with free will, with free education, with free scientific thought, then I would be welcomed into the fray. But because we don't have those structures in place, I'm ostracized or pushed aside or, you know, said to be a quack. But what the reality is that the people of the nation are free to make a choice only if we give them all of the information.
Or if they're open to that information. Lawrence, we're out of time. You're out there helping the medical community, at least those within the medical community who are willing to look at the underlying basis of how they diagnose and treat. Are they really promoting healing, or are they merely medical mechanics? And if they're willing to be honest, most are medical mechanics, and that's why they're not getting the results, but they're rewarded for effort, and that's also part of the illusion. The illusion in almost everything we do is not, for example, there was $400 million given to California for one project. They hired 165 people. 165 people. Where'd all the money went? It went to the person who had the inside corporation and had the inside dealing through the lobbyist who got all the money. So the politicians say, we gave to this. Everybody say, we gave to that, but nothing actually got done. So we're not rewarded in America for the good outcomes, but rather for the effort. So the effort is the illusion. As long as we can tell people we're doing something, they'll never look at whether or not we did it. That's why I went down to New Orleans after billions and billions spent, and I walked through the streets of the Lower Ninth Ward recently, and all I saw was the same devastation as Katrina had left years ago. And one of the people said, you know something, the Corps of Engineers came in here, and they did all this work. If we got a Category 3, we're right back to Katrina all over again. So, but the Corps said, we did it. Congress says, we did it. The governor says, we took the money. Everybody's happy. You've changed nothing. So we've got to understand that getting credit and being rewarded and seeming heroic for our efforts keeps us in the bubble of illusion, and that's where we needn't be. Lawrence, all the best to you. I look forward to another conversation.
Great. Thank you for having me on, Gary.
Lawrence Pavesky, and he is, let's see, his website is drpalevsky.com, P-A-L-E-V-S-K-Y. By the way, we have put up on our website, progressiveradionetwork.com, where you can reach your legislators, so it makes it easier for you to call and tell them no to the FDA. And also this, before we go in the studio, to Elizabeth, who's here to address some of your issues, this is from Mr. Borowitz. It says, a jubilant President Obama said that last night's Republican forum was, quote, the best debate ever. He called it the first good news I've seen since I knelt bin Laden. And among the debate's highlight, the Republican candidates took pain to enumerate their plentiful broods of children, which added up to a number slightly greater than the population of China. For his part, Governor Perry of Texas made the biggest impression by questioning the existence of Social Security, climate change, earth, fire, and wind. Also notable were his pro-execution comments, which tonight won him the coveted endorsement from the National Association for Electric Chair Manufacturers. Quote, we don't have high unemployment in Texas, he noted with pride, because if you don't have a job, we kill you. In studio is Elizabeth. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hello, Gary. Good afternoon. We've had some comments from people that have been watching these debates. The first is a comment about Rick Perry. He seems to have... His candidacy, it seems, is hanging on getting rid of Social Security, but that seems like a fraud. What do you make of all that? Have you been watching him?
Well, I don't believe that he understands that Social Security, which was enacted in 1935 under when we were in the midst of the Great Depression, was meant to be there to help people in the future, and it had a surplus, and a substantial surplus, and there are about 56 million people who draw down their Social Security. In fact, 56 million people without that Social Security check, they would be in abject poverty. So what is Mr. Perry thinks going to happen when he's going to ask 56 million people to stop believing in what's actually keeping them out of abject poverty? And another 85 million people, the baby boomers, who qualify at 65, get their checks at 66, when they're asked, oh, don't worry about this. The reality is it's not a Ponzi scheme. You put into it, and there's 135 million Americans putting into Social Security. There's 56 million taking out. But the way it was structured, it had over a $1.6 trillion surplus, okay? Enough to take us for the next 15 years. Here's the rub. Along the way, the federal government withdrew money out of Social Security, used it in other programs to give them an illusion that they were profitable, or at least had surpluses, and they put IOUs in. Now, if you looked in the Social Security Trust, you would find all these IOUs for over $2 trillion. $2 trillion the government has taken, in effect, borrowed out of the Social Security Trust, put IOUs in there. What's an IOU? It's a promise to the government to repay. Well, how would the Treasury pay? They would have to have the Federal Reserve print money. Well, who's responsible for guaranteeing that money? The U.S. public. So hold on a second. You mean money that the people have already put in from their wages, now if there's a draw down on that money, the government will say, well, now we're going to cash in these T-bills, but who's going to validate the T-bills? What's backing them up? Federal Reserve. That means the Federal Reserve has to come up with something behind that, which means then the people will be double taxed. You will pay to get into Social Security, you will pay then for the deficit. We should never have allowed Alan Greenspan, who was really the architect of this, and subsequent administrations, including Bush Sr., Reagan before him, Clinton, all borrowed from the Social Security Trust. They shouldn't be allowed. They shouldn't make it. Now they should cut back every one of these other... Department of Energy, it's a totally fraudulent organization. These massive bureaucracies like the Defense Department and the for-profit healthcare insurance industry. We should take the money that we're giving these back into Social Security so we have our trillions back, so we do not have to worry about it ever running out of money. Anyone who goes up against Social Security like he did, he may win the hearts and minds of Republicans, him or Mitt Romney, but boy, they have just put their foot against the third rail of the American public. There's no way anyone with a brain would vote for someone like that who wants to take away Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid.
Right.
No way.
Thank you.
Okay. For all of you listening, I want to thank you for listening. I've got a whole lot coming up. A lot of filming. I'm going to be filming 3 new documentaries and showing you information you haven't seen before, but I look forward to seeing a lot of you now that I'm back in New York on the 21st. We're all sold out right now, except school children, not teachers. Teachers make enough money they can pay for a $25 ticket. But the students, Steve Brown has set aside tickets for the students. Some students have taken him up on this. You can call for your student at a high school or university and get a free ticket, and we have 35 tickets set aside that have been paid for students. That number is 877-627-5065. I'm Gary Nall, back in New York. I want to thank you all for watching and listening in. I look forward to sharing more on our next program. And now, stay tuned for a person who has his very own mind, Mike Fader.
The show is produced in our New York City studios. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matthew Bogart. All shows are archived by Kyle Pollard. Our chief archivist is Sharon Pride. And the program director is Jason Tavenfeld.